Here we are in Exodus 10 today, and I want to look at the passage in the sense that most of the commentaries you pick up completely miss the point of this passage. So I'd like to walk through it today with you with just the eyes on a couple of things. We're going to look at just a couple of things, not taking apart the passage in depth, but really just highlighting three little sections. So let's pick up in Exodus chapter 10, verse 1. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Go to Pharaoh, for I have hardened his heart and the heart of his servants, that I may perform these signs of mine among them, and that you may tell in the hearing of your son and of your grandson how I made a mockery of the Egyptians, how I performed my signs among them, that you may know that I am the Lord." And Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh. Now, I want you to notice that passage because of the teaching that's involved here. Most people miss this, but I want you to notice. God says to Moses, as he has said the entire time, "Moses, I am sending you to speak, and they aren't going to listen. Moses, I want you to do this thing, but nobody's going to hear you." This is very similar to what God told Jeremiah, to what God told Isaiah, to really what we find in the New Testament as far as the teaching that goes on there, that the message of God for most people is an absolutely useless episode. It means nothing to them. And I thought about this passage this week. Actually, I was sitting there, and when I read it, I was just sort of mulling it over the way I do. And I looked at this passage for months, and it never hit me before. But then I just laughed out loud. Because, folks, I got to tell you, this is exactly a scenario that I constantly go through with people, where I tell people, they come in, they say, "Pastor, I'm having this issue with such and such." And I say, "Well, have you talked to them about it?" And you know what the answer is, right? Say, "Well, Pastor, that's not going to do any good." All the time. I could just record that on a tape recorder. People walk in my office, I just press play. Same conversation over and over and over again. "I'm having this problem with my husband. I'm having this problem with my wife. I'm having this problem with my kids." "Well, have you talked to them about it?" "Well, that's the thing. I know that's not going to do any good. I'm going to talk, and they're not going to listen." And you know what, folks? I got to tell you something. That's beside the point. This goes back to something I talk about all the time. All the time. If you are in the results business, you are going to be highly disappointed with life. I just want you to know that. If you think you're going to go out and do such and such and say such and such and these things are going to happen, that's just simply not true. Most of the time, and not to discourage you, and then when I say not to discourage you, I'm about to say a tremendously discouraging thing, right? Not to discourage you. But most of the time, when you do the right thing, say the right thing, and take the right action, it means absolutely nothing to the people around you and for whom you are doing it. Like all of those countless mothers who walk through the house and they clean up, and they're like, "Nobody appreciates me," and they're talking to themselves. "Nobody appreciates me. Nobody even notices all this stuff. Look at this mess." My mom would say, "The beatenest mess. This is the beatenest mess I've ever seen." Well, she's tried to show us how to clean. She's tried to teach us how to take responsibility. Guess what? Didn't make a lick of difference. Results are not your problem. Results are not your issue. God has not called you to produce results. God has called you to faithfulness. Right action, right word, He's in charge of what happens next. You can't touch a human heart. You can't say, and I know you do this all the time, "How do I say this so that this person does this?" There's no such thing, folks. These things that we create in our mind, "Oh, how do I say this the right way so that so that they will do this. And you know what? I'm kind of afraid to say this to them, because if I say this to them, they're going to do this. The 1 out of 10 times that it works out the way you think it's going to work is not worth it. Rather, what you should concentrate on is, what would God have me do? Not, how do I make it work? Not, how do I reach this other person? Not, how do I convince someone that I'm right? That does not exist in the real world. That's just a figment of your imagination. And Moses' big problem at the beginning of this thing was, God, I don't want to do that. They're not going to listen. That's not... But now, look at him. God says to Moses, look, Moses, I'm going to do this thing. I want you to go talk to Pharaoh, and he's not going to listen. And Moses doesn't balk, he just does it. Moses has grown. Moses is a changed being. But God gives us a hint of why and where he's doing what he's doing. Notice again the passage. Look again in verse 2. And that you may tell in the hearing of your son and of your grandson how I made a mockery of the Egyptians, how I performed signs among them, that you may know that I am the Lord. Moses, you get the benefit of this, but really the real benefit is for future generations. What I'm doing in Egypt is going to be a sustaining story. Because remember, the rest of Israel is not really in on these deliberations. All they see is Moses going to Pharaoh, Pharaoh saying no, and God judging. But they don't really see the working that's going on. They kind of know the miracle, but they're really in some ways in the dark. And if Moses goes to see Pharaoh and Pharaoh doesn't listen, most people look at that and go, man, we've got a pretty ineffective leader here. Moses talks to these guys till he's blue in the face and they don't listen. And God says here, Moses, they aren't supposed to listen. I've ordained it so that Pharaoh's heart will be hardened, and when his heart is hardened, I'm going to do this miracle. The people will see the miracle, and future generations will hearken back to it in their hardest moments and in their most difficult times and say, well, God did that for us in the past. Surely we can trust him in the future. Surely we can trust him for today. And we spend so much of our time concentrating on how we can get an end result. And folks, that's not our calling. Our calling is to do rightly, to speak rightly, to obey God in the now. It's not about getting something done. It's not about moving forces so that they may move in our favor. Results orientation in your life will lead to frustration and debilitating paralysis as you sit in an action trying to figure out what to do, when you should ask a much simpler question, what would God have me do? And just by brief example, that's why when Scripture says, treat those with kindness, tenderness, gentleness, have a soft heart before me and before other people, God is not focused on what you can get people to do. He's focused on you going through it rightly. And folks, the attitude of anger, frustration, the yelling, all that stuff, all that does is try and move people to do things, but it doesn't actually accomplish anything God would have you accomplish. Tender heart may get shut down. Tender heart may get ignored, but it's what you're called to do. And that's where our focus needs to be. Not results orientation, faithful orientation. And Moses has changed. Now he's moving in a direction God would have him move. And so we pick up verse 3. And Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh, and he said to him, "Thus saith the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, how long will you refuse to humble yourself before me?" Notice they're asking the question, knowing full well that God says he's going to be hardened. I just think that's fantastic. "For if you refuse to let my people go, behold, tomorrow I will bring locusts on your territory, and they shall cover the surface of the land, so that no one shall be able to see the land. They shall also eat the rest of what is escaped, what is left to you from the hail." Remember the hail? "And they shall eat every tree with sprouts for you out of the field." Now that's the first miracle. Now I want you to notice something. This is where most commentators completely miss the boat. There are these paradigms, these patterns that people sort of put on the text. And what commentators have done is they've looked at the book of Exodus and they go, okay, he does this many miracles and then he has an unannounced miracle. And then he does this many miracles and he has an unannounced miracle. And they say, okay, when he comes to Exodus 10, he has this announced miracle and then he has this unannounced miracle. That actually is not true. And people have missed the point. I'm hoping you'll get the point. But people miss the point in the text. God announces his first miracle, and his first miracle is locust. Now, folks, I usually plan my sermons about a year ahead. Okay, so last year about this time, I was thinking, okay, we'll be in Exodus in the summer, and we're going to do this, this, and this, and it'll probably work out this long. Right? So I'm sitting there last year. Now, I got to. You don't even know what goes into this, and you know, frankly, you don't appreciate it. You never will. Okay? Because last year, when I was determining when we would teach on the locusts, the complicated rubric I went into perfectly timed the locusts with the hatching of the cicadas this week. Do you realize what I go through for you people? You'll just never appreciate it. I love to hear those this week. I thought about it. The first thing, Monday morning, I woke up and I said, "Oh, that sound. Yes, I was right a year ago." And I've been picking up those dead things all week. I love those things. I love when the dogs eat them and then they throw them up. That's just great to me. I don't have a dog. The first miracle is the locust. But the second miracle, they say, is unannounced, but it's not unannounced. I want you to look at verse 6. "Then your houses shall be filled, and the houses of all your servants, and the houses of the Egyptians, with something which neither your fathers nor your grandfathers have seen from the day that they came upon the earth until this day." And he turned and went out from Pharaoh. Now, I want you to notice something. He announced the miracle of the locusts. Most commentators lumped verse 6 in with the locust, but that's not true. There's a break. And the break is, I'm going to do this thing, they're going to eat up everything that's left, and then in verse 6, I'm going to do a thing that nobody has ever seen on the face of the planet from the time that human beings began. Now, folks, I want you to know something. If God ever says to you, he appears in a burning bush, and he says, "Hey, Doran, I'm going to do a thing in your life that nobody on earth has ever seen," you should be terrified. This is not like when you go home and your mom and your dad say, "Hey, we're going to show you something. We're going to show you something you've never seen. This is going to be great." And you get kind of excited. You know how kids get excited like that. My kids have been my kids long enough that they react the way you should with God. That whenever I say, "Hey, I'm going to do something you've never seen," they go, "Oh." But God says, in the homes of the Egyptians, in your house, Pharaoh, in the house of your servants, i.e. the magicians, I'm going to do a thing that's never been seen on the face of the earth. Not ever. So there are two miracles announced here. And let's go forward. Verse 6b. "Came upon the earth until this day," and the last phrase of verse 6, "and he turned and went out from Pharaoh." This is a very significant point in the relationship between Moses and Pharaoh. Moses shows up, and he does not show up as an emissary of God. He shows up as simply a messenger. He delivers the message, and to the God incarnate on earth, Pharaoh, he turns his back and walks out as if Pharaoh means nothing. Folks, we don't have the ability to appreciate this moment. All of the court of Pharaoh must have recognized it. He does not show up with any obedience. He does not show up with any humility. He does not show up as if he's addressing somebody very important. Moses shows up and in confidence delivers the message of God, and he turns his back on Pharaoh and he simply walks out. No fear of evil, with complete confidence in his God. Folks, I think that's a great way to live. And then something happens, verse 7. And Pharaoh's servants said to him, notice, Moses walks out, and then they say to him, I imagine the moment that Moses cleared the doorway and the door shut, those servants came forward in absolute haste. Pharaoh, how long will this man be a snare to us? Let the men go that they may serve the Lord their God. Do you not realize that Egypt is destroyed? This is that moment of clarity in which up to this point, all of Pharaoh's servants, all of his magicians, have been relying on their old system, their old way of dealing with the world, their old way of making things happen. And at this point, even they have learned we are powerless before this man and his God. And they come forward and they say, Pharaoh, you've got to stop this. This is crazy. Don't you realize it's all over? Our country is destroyed. If this miracle happens, the last of what we have is going to be absolutely destroyed. We've been trying to prop up things. Our economy is in shambles. Things are falling apart. Don't you realize? It's all over. Stop it. And what they receive back really is a blank stare. Because folks, God said it in verse 1. I'm going to harden Pharaoh's heart. And what harden means is he's going to remain in the delusion that is ordinary human beings. I'm not going to rescue him from it. That's who he's going to be. Can you imagine the frustration of being one of Pharaoh's magicians at this point? You're dealing with someone who simply will not listen to the facts, who will not understand what's going on objectively in time and space. He simply refuses to see. If you ever want to know what this feels like, go to Washington, D.C. and talk to a congressman. I don't discount that, by the way. Maybe God is doing some hardening these days. I'm not sure. Verse 8. So Moses and Aaron were brought back to Pharaoh, and he said to them, okay, go serve the Lord your God. Who are the ones that are going? Moses says, we shall all go with our young ones and our old ones and our sons and our daughters, with our flocks, our herds. We will go, for we must hold a feast to the Lord. Then he said to him, thus may the Lord be with you. If I ever let you and your little ones go, take heed, for the evil is in your mind. Not so. Now the men among you can go. Serve the Lord, and that is what you desire. So they were driven out from Pharaoh's presence. Notice what just happened. I love the Lord, folks. His mastery of circumstances and even the smallest details are absolutely amazing. Remember, Pharaoh's servants come forward. It's all over. Don't you realize?
We have $14.3 trillion in debt. It's all over.
And he says, okay, okay. Get Moses in here. Moses, okay. We're going to let you go. Who's going? Moses responds as calmly as you please. Oh, all of us. Well, I thought it would be just you and the men. I thought you'd leave your families here. But if it's all of you, no. No, no. All right. So the magicians, they're sitting there. They're like, please, please, it's all over. He says, okay, okay. And he gets them in there, and the magicians are, he's going to let them go. This is great. They're all excited. Maybe we can salvage this situation. All right, who's going? Well, all of us are going. All right, then no. And then the magician is like, ah! You just said you're going, and now. 10 seconds ago, they had a conversation where he said, it's all over. Don't you see? And you said, yes, okay, I understand. And now you say, never mind. I'm telling you, it's fantastic, isn't it? Now it came about midnight that the Lord... Oh, I'm sorry. Wrong passage. All right. And the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand over the land of Egypt and the locusts, and they may come upon the land of Egypt and eat every plant of the land, even all that the hail has left. So Moses stretched out his staff over the land of Egypt, and the Lord directed an east wind on the land all that day and all that night. And when it was morning, the east wind brought the locusts. And the locusts came up over all the land of Egypt, settled on all the territory of Egypt, and they were ruinous and numerous in number. There had never been so many locusts, nor would there be so many again. For they covered the surface of the whole land so that the land was darkened, and they ate every plant of the land and all the fruit of the trees and all the hail that had left. Thus nothing green was left on tree or plant of the field in all of the land of Egypt. And then Pharaoh hurriedly called for Moses and Aaron, and he said, I have sinned against the Lord your God. By the way, that's a meaningless statement that he's saying here. Now therefore, please forgive my sin only this once, and make supplication to the Lord your God that he would only remove this death from me. And went out from Pharaoh and made supplication to the Lord. So the Lord shifted the wind to a very strong west wind, which took up the locusts and drove them into the Red Sea. Not one locust was left in the territory of Egypt, but the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he did not let the sons of Israel go. We will not go into this passage today. But just notice, this week as you deal with cicadas, hearken back to this passage and think on it. The numbers of cicadas always kind of come up, and you're just kind of amazed at where they are. Think about these locusts on every square inch of the land, everything green, destroyed. And Pharaoh's repentance coming much too late. And we all know it's just talk anyway. But then in verse 21, I want you to notice what was referred to in verse 6. God said, I'm going to do a thing that's never been seen on the earth. And folks, it's never been seen since either. Then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand towards the sky that there may be darkness over the land of Egypt, even a darkness which may be felt. And so Moses stretched out his hand towards the sky, and there was a thick darkness in all the land of Egypt for 3 days. They did not see one another, nor did they rise from his place for 3 days. But all the sons of Israel had light in their dwellings. And then Pharaoh called Moses and said, go serve the Lord, only let your flocks and your herds be detained. Notice, Moses, stretch out your hand towards the sky that a darkness may be settled on the earth. And I want you to notice the nature of this darkness. This is not hyperbole, nor is it some sort of clever thing going on in the language. It is literal. God said, a darkness falls which can actually be felt. Now, this is going to require some imagination. But I want you to realize that for any of you who have ever been in a cave, and I mean one of those caves that are deep, dark, and buried in the earth, there's a wonderful moment that comes when you get to the bottom of that cave. almost every time I've ever been in a cave, somebody says, hey, let's turn off all the lights so that we can see what darkness looks like. And people turn off the lights, and you're just sitting there in pitch black. It is key, for any of you who have ever been caving, to at that moment make sure you do not move. Because if you move, you will hit your head on something. It's just the way it is. You thought you knew what things looked like when the lights were on. When you turn them off and you think, oh yeah, I remember, I'm only this far away from the wall, and you reach out and it's not there. I've had that sickening realization before where I thought, okay, the wall's right here, and I went like that and I fell forward and cracked my head in the middle of a dark cave. So for any of you who ever find yourself in the Ickesburg cave, make sure you get to the bottom of that and turn those lights off. Because rarely do human beings ever get to know what real darkness looks like. Real darkness, which you could be there for 1,000 years and your eyes would never adjust. Actually, if you were there long enough, your eyes will stop working. That's the way it is. And I remember going to a cave years ago, and it was filled with trout. This dark cave, these cave-dwelling trout. And all of the trout were born with eyes. And after living in that long enough, their bodies couldn't use them, so they all became blind. That's what kind of darkness we're talking about. Commentators like to think, oh, this is some sort of dust bowl or some sort of fog that God causes. No, I want you to realize what the passage literally says. That God takes darkness and He makes a substance out of it. Remember, darkness is the absence of light. That's all it is, right? You turn your lights off at night, the light goes away, and what you were left with is dark. What the passage says here, and says literally, is that God creates a darkness which could actually be felt. It's something between you and me, no matter how close we are, and which my eyes cannot get used to, cannot see through, and for 3 days this goes on, and nothing improves. It's dark. It's a darkness that they can reach out and almost grasp. They can move their arms through it and they know it's there. God takes darkness and gives it physical form. Do you realize the nature of this miracle? Verse 6. This is a miracle like nobody has ever seen on earth. This has never, ever happened. So there you are as an Egyptian, and you're sitting in your house, and your baby is crying, and it's so dark that you literally can't see your hand in front of your face because there's something in front of you. You can take your glasses off and jam your hand up to your eye, and you can't see your eye because there's simply no light at all. You can feel it, but your hand passes through it, and there's nothing there, but you know there's something. You can feel it. So you find yourself groping across the floor to get to your baby. And as it says in the passage, they just sat in their spots for 3 days, not knowing how long this was going to last, just sitting there with their eyes, never getting used to it, sitting in darkness. That's the nature of this miracle. This is not a cloud of dust. It is not a bank of fog. This is darkness in embodied form. Crazy, isn't it? Our God can do that. I just think that's the greatest thing I've ever heard. He can give body to something that doesn't really have a form, simply the absence of light, and God makes it a thing. But over in the Israelite camp, everything's fine. They have lights in their homes. Day, night goes on as normal. And they're just fine. And then the darkness leaves. How terrifying must that have been? And then suddenly it's lifted after 3 days, and then Pharaoh calls Moses and says, go serve the Lord, only let your flocks and your herds be detained. Even your little ones may go with you. No, hold. Now Pharaoh is starting to negotiate. Okay, before, And don't you know the magicians now, they're like, okay, now he's listening. After the darkness for 3 days and they're all sitting there in the dark with nothing to do but wait, Pharaoh says, okay, everybody can go, but you leave your livestock. Verse 25. But Moses said, no, you must also let us have our sacrifices and burnt offerings, that we may sacrifice them to the Lord our God. Therefore, our livestock too will go with us. Notice this next phrase. Not a hoof will be left behind, for we shall take some of them and serve the Lord our God. And until we arrive there, we ourselves do not know what we will serve the Lord. But the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he was not willing to let them go. And Pharaoh said to him, get away from me. Beware that you do not see my face again, for the day you see my face, you shall die. And Moses says, you are right. I'll never see your face again. I want you to realize at this moment, Pharaoh's fate is sealed. What we knew in proposition is now fact. What we knew God was doing is now complete. Pharaoh is sealed up in his hardness, and he is going to crash his nation in the process. He did not do it because he's arrogant or pride. He did it because God willed it. God simply laid a judgment on Pharaoh and said, Pharaoh, you have no chance. I'm never offering you redemption. I'm never offering you a second chance. I'm never going to do a work in your life other than judgment. That's my relationship to Pharaoh. Folks, that's a terrifying place to be. Jonathan Edwards put it in his sermon, Sinners in the Hand of an Angry God. Like spiders hanging from a single thread over the pit of hell. That is Pharaoh's only relationship to God, and never anything else. But that's not you. It'll never be you. For we who believe, who have trusted on Christ, there's never a hardness of heart that cannot be repented of. There's never a hardness of heart that cannot be melted. There's never a hardness of heart in our stubborn, willful sinfulness that cannot be turned away from and brought into a line with the will of God. Christian, I would just urge you strongly, exhort even, that in light of what God has done for us, never liken yourself to Pharaoh. Never put yourself in such stubborn sinfulness that there's even the hint that you have something in common with Pharaoh. You've tasted redemption. You've been on the receiving end of grace. Don't ever put yourself in a position where you say, I'm going to do this thing, hang the consequences, and hang everybody else. Just never put yourself there. You'll always lose. Not to mention, there's no sin in its doing that's worth that kind of position. I've never seen anybody ever, years after a sinful action, say, I was so glad I did that. Never. I remember years ago dealing with somebody I went to Bible college with, who she decided to leave her husband. And she left, and she underwent discipline and all of that. And years later, she contacted me. She said, you know what? I was just wrong. She said, I'm stuck with what I have, and God's found a way to reach me, and I'm okay. But what was I thinking? What was I doing? Why would I ever put myself in a relationship to God that way? Why? So now she's sitting there with all this junk in her past and all this baggage, with all this regret. But folks, it didn't have to be. And it doesn't have to be for you. It's not about results. It's about obedience. It's not about getting what we want. It's just about walking with God. Always do that. Let's go to prayer. Father, we do praise Your name. You're just so good. And You're powerful. Crazy powerful. We state it as a proposition, Your omnipotence. But rarely do we look at it in its content. And these two miracles, the control of animals that destroy with just a word, just a blowing of the wind, and the very embodiment of darkness. These are things which are impossible, impossible to call, impossible to predict, and impossible to do. And yet You do them with as little thought as it takes to flick a fly. Let us stand in awe of You in that. And Father, help us to never stand toe to toe, face against You, determined to our own will. In light of a God like that, I'm simply a fool. And in light of the regret that follows, it's simply failure. In Your name we pray. Amen. Go in peace in the Lord. Have a great day.